Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Bowlology Report. A massive week in cricket again. Some fantastic finishes to Test match cricket. Pakistan, West Indies, has been a wonderful series. And India and England, Joe Root absolutely dominating. Previous tests, some great lower order batting by Shami and Bumrah. But we're going to change tact a little bit here. The new innovation into cricket is the 100 over in England, and we're lucky enough to have one of Australia's finest test batsmen, finest left-arm wrist spinners as well, a best of six in test match cricket. He coaches all around the world. You can hear him on SEN and see him on Channel 7 Cricket. I'm talking about the main man, the hairy man, Simon Kadich. Kaddo, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Flint.
Now, you just look like you're quarantining nicely. Is it Barbados? I can see there.
Just on the beaches of Barbados. No, thankfully, I'm back home in Sydney. I'm day four of quarantine, so only 10 days to go, but who's counting?
You're still doing throwdowns? You like your throwdowns?
Look, I've got into a routine now. This is my third one, having done a couple of IPL stints in the last sort of 12 months. So I'm getting used to quarantine now and got my daily routine all sorted at the moment. Unfortunately, jet lag's getting me up at 4 a.m. So it's a long day, but I'm getting there.
And Kaddo, you know, I mentioned in the introduction, you know, you went over to coach the Manchester Originals. Could they get a better name than that? Like the Manchester Maulers?
Hey, what's wrong with the Originals? We love it. I think it's original, obviously. So, I mean, look, in terms of the 100, I think, you know, we went there not knowing what to expect. Obviously, a new competition. There's been a lot of talk about it. There's been a lot of negativity about it, particularly in English cricket and the way it was formed and opposition from some of the counties to it. But I think what we saw was a magnificent product. The players certainly embraced it. It was great for both men and women's game. I think the women certainly enjoyed playing, you know, in before our games. And I think we shared that the same venues. We helped each other out at training at different stages. And I think there was a real camaraderie between both groups starting the tournament. So, yeah, overall, the cricket that was played was excellent. There was a few little differences to the format in terms of some of the rule changes. But, yeah, the players you know, put on a great show, and it was great to be part of.
You know, just to get you to elaborate a bit on that, you know, the different rules in the 100 compared to T20 cricket, like what did you like? You know, what can a program like the Big Bash actually copy from the 100? And then also a few of the subtle tactical differences that the 100, you know, with the bowlers can bowl 10 balls in a row and consecutive overs from one end. Can you elaborate a bit more on, and I'm sure you've had a little bit of a debrief in quarantine, on the cons of the 100 and what other leagues can learn from it?
Yeah, look, I think initially everyone thought, how similar is it going to be to T20? Because obviously there's only 20 balls less. And it felt like there was a big difference, particularly from a batting perspective, because you're only bowling five ball sets, and we can't call them overs, Flynn. They're sets. So it was five balls in the set. And what we found was that, you know, if a batsman had a dot ball early in the set, then that only being five and not having the extra ball at the end, it caught up really quickly. So there was certainly some perceived pressure on the batsman. And once they started to get a feel for the rhythm of the innings, that changed as the tournament went on. But I think you alluded to one of the big differences in the game is that five ball in the set, but there was 10 balls bowled at each end. So that sped up the game. And if the captain wanted to, he could bowl someone two consecutive sets of five. So you could bowl 10 balls on the bounce, which happened a fair bit. And it added a difference to the game where, you know, if someone had the wood over and got a wicket in that first set of five, particularly in the power play, captains were really inclined to see the same bowler go again, particularly if there's a new batsman out there. So it just added a different element to the game. I think the other thing that was really good was that when you lost a wicket, the new batsman had to take strike. So particularly at the back end of the innings, it benefits the bowling team in the fact that you can potentially build more pressure on that new batsman if there's another set batsman in, and that maybe brought the scores down a little bit. So there was that. The time frame, I think we had 65 minutes to bowl the 100 balls, which was speeding things up, which was good. And if you didn't bowl 95 balls by the allotted time, the cutoff time, then the captain, the bowling captain, had to bring an extra fielder into the ring, which happened a few times. So there was an incentive there for making sure that teams were getting through the balls and all that. So, yeah, overall, really positive experience. It was on free-to-air TV, which is the first time since 2005 in the UK. So they obviously want to take it to a new audience. And I think that move in itself, from all reports, proved to be very popular with the English public, where from all reports, the ratings were outstanding on both free-to-air and also Sky. So, yeah, overall, really positive experience. And the standard of cricket that we witnessed was excellent. We had a number of our players at Manchester who'd had very good blast campaigns for their respective counties, came to the 100, started well, but when the pressure built at the back end of the tournament, the big games came around, they found it tough because some of the world's best players were there and the talent pool was condensed into eight teams. So it certainly made for a tougher competition than probably some of them had experienced in the blast competition in the UK.
Condensed tournament with the best players. Geez, you might be onto something there.
Well, it only went for a month and there was eight games. So, you know, there was a lot riding on those eight games, and you have four games at home. And I guess from our perspective, we got hit the hardest in terms of having two games washed out at home. And that really sort of stalled our progress when we were building some good momentum. So that puts a lot of pressure on. And I think, you know, a tight, condensed schedule, the players certainly enjoy it because the overseas boys know that they can come in for a month, they do their work, and then they can move on to their next challenge. And I think all the players enjoyed the way the schedule was and the format.
Yeah, when there's been complaints about the Big Bash that it goes for too long, well, one of the criteria to back that up for myself, having commentated from the first year, is I think the intensity, particularly early in the tournament, has dropped a little bit. But, oh, yeah, we can make up a win at home later on. But when it's shorter, you know, every game, you know, every over, every ball is absolute premium. What about from a coaching perspective, the difference between T20 and then the 100?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, we weren't sure of whether there was going to be any trends in the game, and because there's no history of, there'd been a few practice games played, but there wasn't a lot to go on. So we were sort of, I guess, just dwelling on things that had happened in the blast and any trends that have happened in English cricket, because obviously the conditions there are different to some of the other tournaments that I certainly have worked in recent times. So, yeah, the thing that we found early was that, you know, some of the wickets had been used, and it's been a lot of cricket played in the UK this summer. And so from that respect, you know, there were some tired wickets, which changed, you know, the dynamic of the game. And actually, I think it changed it for the good. You know, some of the batsmen just couldn't go out there and, you know, slam fours and sixes all the time. There actually had to be some batsmanship and some craft. So I think that added to the game. There was, you know, sometimes 130 was a winning score, you know, which when you think about 100 balls, you probably think that's quite low scoring when, you know, in a T20, 120 ball game, you know, normally pars around the 180 mark. So I think, you know, we started to learn a few things about the trends in the game, the fact that there's only five balls in the set. Bowlers can potentially bowl, you know, 10 balls on the bounce and have an impact there, particularly with a new ball early if it's swinging, which it did at times in England. So, yeah, there was a lot of learnings from it. And I think from a coaching perspective, what I really liked was there's a lot of really good talent over there. We had a fantastic group of young guys to work with, fantastic characters, great to get to start to know them now and you know, help develop them, I guess, from a cricket perspective. They've already got plenty of cricket ability. It's more around, you know, I think the challenge now is around them gaining experience and their thinking around how they work their way through situations under pressure, because that was probably the one thing that we saw with a young team, having had to make a number of changes through injury and stuff, was that when the pressure came, a lot of our decision-making under pressure was questionable, and we probably took more wrong options than we got right. And ultimately that cost us at the back end of the tournament when we were in with a great chance to finish top three.
Yeah, sounds like a great experience. So we're in a different landscape around the world, and cricket's affected like no other, and the amount of quarantining for players and coaching has got to obviously take effect. So you've given up the RCB coaching. Is that just for this last leg, or is it indefinitely?
Yeah, it was just for this last leg. I guess what happened was, you know, once the decision was made around the rescheduling, it all happened whilst I was away during the 100. And unfortunately, during the 100, I knew that I was potentially going to be away for maybe 3.5 months once the dates came in and quarantine on the back of the IPL finishing in mid-October. So once I realised that, you know, I was potentially not going to get home until the end of October, and then the situation changed in Sydney with the lockdown and homeschooling being extended until, well, indefinitely really, it potentially could be, you know, into term four until the end of the year. So I realised that, you know, that was going to be a big ask for my wife to look after two boys by herself. So I made the decision that, you know, once the 100 was over, I'd come home and get back on deck. So I'm really comfortable with that decision. I'm not sure how, obviously, you know, it goes down in IPL circles, given that it is a big tournament. And, you know, we had a great start to the tournament this year, and it was a tough decision, but I know that I'm doing the right thing by my family. And, you know, we always talk about family coming first in these COVID times, and I certainly make sure of that.
Two names you coach over there, two superstars. Can you give some insights into Virat Kohli and AB de Villiers, particularly, you know, coaching probably the most famous and most influential player in the world at home? Did you have to tread carefully around Virat, or were you impressed straight away by his attitude?
Look, I was really impressed. I mean, I played against him when he was a kid, starting out in, I think, 2009. And we had a bit of a joke about it because, you know, you look at him now and he's cut like a Greek god. But back then he was like a puffed up party boy. We had a bit of a joke about that. And I showed him a photo of it. So he sort of broke the ice that way. But, you know, I've obviously got a huge amount of respect for what he's achieved in the game so far. And I guess from a coaching perspective, you know, there's nothing I'm going to teach him about batting. But what I found really refreshing was that, for a man of his ability and what he's achieved in the game, he's still really open around his game and trying to improve things. So, you know, he still asks for to watch things, little things at training technically. He's obviously a master technician, so he's always looking for to make sure his game's in order. But the big thing for me was just trying to build that trust with him and connection, particularly from that leadership point of view. And having done the job, you know, myself as a captain, I realised that as coach, it's really important that he feels comfortable being in charge and making all the calling all the shots, because that's the dynamic that, you know, I learn as a captain, and I'm really, you know, it's one of my, I guess, priorities as a coach is to make sure the captain feels like he's calling the shots and is in control. So I was just mainly trying to support him as much as I could. He was brilliant around our group. You know, when you ask for leadership, I mean, he's second to none in a way that, you know, the guys always, you know, are always going to play for him, but also he's just a natural competitor. So, you know, regardless of where the game's at, you know that he's 100% having a crack at the game, trying to win it. You know, he's probably the most professional player I've ever seen. I mean, we obviously played with some of the most professional Australian guys in our era, Flem, that trained harder than anyone in the game. And I'd say, I think he's taken it to a different level, on and off the field with cricket side of things, but also the physical side of things. So from a leadership perspective, mate, you can't ask for much more from a guy in terms of the way he goes about it and the respect he's shown by everyone there. And then when you get to de Villiers, well, mate, you know, it's hard to find enough adjectives for him, because, you know, if he's not the greatest T20 player ever, then I'm not sure who is. I mean, Chris Gayle's probably going to argue that, being the universe boss, but you know, AB's, you know, he's all class. I mean, the role we got him to play in these last two seasons is probably slightly different to previous years, where we've actually batted him a bit lower and got him to try and control the back end of the innings. And the way he took that and has mastered it. Well, no, I shouldn't say mastered it. He already had mastered the game, but this was probably a new challenge for him, and he's played it magnificently in these last two seasons. The amount of times he can get 70 off 30 balls in the last 10 overs of a game in T20 is just remarkable. I think we've seen him done it. He's probably done it about three or four times in each season in these last 2 years. So a phenomenal player. It's based on having a very, very good technique, which obviously he honed over many years for South Africa, and having such a fine test record. And he's also got the power game of T20 now, and he's so good at playing cat and mouse with the bowlers. I just think he's extremely clever. He outthinks the bowlers, and he's got the technique to back it up, and just a wonderful player to have in your group and to work with.
Yeah, going back from IPL now to test match cricket and intriguing series, India and England. There's a lot of conjecture on, will they have a full squad? But just assuming that England do have a full squad, how successful could they be over in Australia next summer?
Look, the biggest challenge they always have coming here is obviously how their bowlers are going to take 20 wickets on our flatter wickets than they get in England, because they are so used to the ball moving around and doing a bit. So that will still be a challenge for them. I think losing the airspeed of someone like Jofra Archer, who can shake up the Australian batting lineup, and particularly the tail. We know that in Australia, if the tail wags, you can get, you know, those sort of 150 runs plus from sort of seven down, and that can be the difference between winning and losing tests. So he's a massive loss. Potentially Mark Wood's got a shoulder injury at the moment. Not sure how serious that is. You know, they've had a number of injuries. Wokes is a very good cricketer. He's out at the moment. You know, there's going to be some issues there for them from a bowling perspective. You know, they're probably still not quite settled on who their number one spinner is. And we know that in Australia, you need to have someone bowling 20 to 30 overs a day to give the quicks a breather to rotate them. So I think Australia's definitely got a big advantage in our conditions with our attack and with Nathan Lyon. And particularly after he had the summer he had last year, he would have been disappointed with the summer he had. And I think he'll be keen to bounce back from that. So I think it's going to come down to top six as usual, and probably potentially the engine room of the top three or four of both teams. And at the moment, I think Australia should have the advantage. We haven't played much cricket, test cricket, but when you've got Warner, Labuschagne and Smith in home conditions, I'd be backing in them in every day of the week compared to the England top three or four. And Joe Root's a lone wolf at the moment. He's got a bit of support in this Headingley test from the openers, but the England batting lineup, you know, they've been having issues at the top. They probably haven't been settled, and they're going to come into some foreign conditions here against what is a very good Australian attack. So, I think Australia should be favourites, but it'd be interesting to see, because we haven't played a lot of test cricket of late.
Yeah, definitely. Just talking about the engine room, can you talk about your career and the adjustment, middle order player, 20-odd tests, getting told you're never going to play again, going out and punching out 1,500 runs, but the change in technique, and then also how to adapt from being a middle order player to averaging 50 opening up for Australia?
Yeah, I guess the biggest change, Flem, probably came in my mindset the second time around. After being told in 2007 that I was never going to get picked for Australia again, I think the biggest difference to my game was that, you know, I think I was about 31 years of age at the time when I got told, and I still felt like I had plenty of cricket left in me. And I guess the mindset, and it had always been this way, but I think maybe I sharpened the focus a bit more, was that wherever I played my cricket, whether it was Randwick, Petersham, New South Wales, county cricket, wherever, I was just going to try and enjoy my cricket and try and win games of cricket for my team, wherever they may be. And as soon as – I think when you're captain, that helps as well, because your main focus is on getting best out of the 10 other guys and also yourself. And that probably took a bit of pressure off me, but I think that focus just, took the pressure off my personal batting, and I went out there and played really well. And from a technical point of view, the only probably change that I – made from probably the 05 Ashes to getting back in 2008 was just the timing of my prelim movement. During the 05 Ashes, it was a bit late, and then I was finding myself not having a secondary movement and then just playing with my hands. Come 2008, I'd rectified the timing of that, made it back to how it was previously. Earlier, I was then making a secondary movement either forward or back and found myself playing really well again. So it was only a small adjustment, but it made a big difference. And combined with that mindset change, I just went out there and really enjoyed my cricket. And I think I definitely played my best cricket from 2008 to the end of my career in sort of early 2014. And I think a lot of it came down to, yeah, that making the most of that last opportunity. I also think you mentioned about the opening, the batting. I think I'd never really got to bat at the top of the order for Australia apart from, I think, the 04 series in India when Ricky Ponting was injured. And I'd always probably consider myself a top order player, but getting to open in that last phase definitely suited me because I didn't chew up any nervous energy waiting, sitting around waiting to bat. I just got out there and got on with it. And I think being in an opening partnership as well helped because it felt like I became, you know, part of a team within the team. And I know that's something that, you know, whether it was Haydos, whether it was Jakesy, whether it was Hughesy, whether it was Shane Watson, any of those four partners, always sort of the main focus was on our partnership rather than myself. And I think that took a lot of pressure off my own game as well. And I loved opening with all four of them. But in at the end of it all, I think I probably got to open with Watto the most and really cherished that partnership. And, yeah, was disappointed it got cut short, unfortunately, at the end when we got told that they wanted to bed down the opening partnership for the 2013 Ashes.
Yeah, and what year was that?
I think it was in about 2010, something like that. So
yeah. And you went away quietly too. Generally, your attitude is, you know, I'll come at you. And just when you got told, you know, when you made that the press conferences and you ticked a lot of boxes that the current players and recently former players would have agreed with totally, did you come up with that yourself? Did management say, well, you got nothing to lose by getting on the front foot there? What motivated it?
No, it was purely off my own back. No, I just felt like I needed to get it off my chest. I felt like if I'd kept hold of it all, then it probably would have destroyed me because I was so upset with the fact that, as you know, mate, like as all of us know that have set out on this journey to try and, you know, be the best you possibly can and play for Australia. And when you've achieved that and you know that you're doing a good job at it and you get cut short, you feel like, you know, it's obviously a knife to the heart. And, you know, it was hard to hear what was going on and the reasons for it. And I just wasn't going to accept that the reasons I was given were legitimate and were being brutally honest. So I felt like I needed to get off my chest. I'm glad I did get off my chest. But it was also, you know, having seen how Australian cricket was going at the time and seeing it firsthand in first-class cricket for New South Wales, it was a concern because we'd been part of an era that had been so successful. And then to see the decisions that were getting made, you know, at state level around selection and players getting picked when they potentially hadn't earned the right and then potentially that filtering into the Australian team, you know, that was something that really dismayed me and a lot of other players. So it wasn't probably just coming from my perspective. No. We all had seen what was happening in Australian cricket and we were all dismayed at what was going on. So if anything, I was just probably happy to get the trumpet out and blow that, you know, make more of an awareness about it from a player's perspective. And I certainly got a lot of positive feedback around what was said. So it was nice to get it off the chest and then be able to move on, mate. Once it was done and dusted, I knew my time was up. And I was able to just go back and enjoy playing club cricket, playing cricket for New South Wales, playing county cricket, playing BBL cricket. Because at the end of the day, mate, I still love playing the game and that's what I was passionate about. So I knew that I was never going to get picked again and I was happy to go down swinging.
Yeah. And I mean, the main thing, I suppose, it gave you closure. But, you know, for the rest of the cricketing fraternity, you're one of the few Australian openers to average 50. You touched on even not just as much you individually. And we're struggling right now to get an opening partner for Dave Warner, who's getting older himself. You know, the Cadditch Watson opening, and he was probably at his best as a batsman opening with yourself. And it was the only right-hand batsman that you open with. The other boys were all left-handers. Could you just touch on quickly all those four batsmen individually?
Yeah, well, starting with Watto, I mean, that was the other part of it that made it so upsetting because he was one of the first person that I got in touch with once I'd heard the news. And I was upset for the fact that we couldn't open the batting again. And as it played out, as you rightly said, you know, that was his best position in the Australian test team during that phase of his career. And it ended up ultimately hurting his test career as well. So that's what hurt as well, because we had something that was working really well. We complemented each other well. We loved doing it together. And that was taking away what we thought was unfairly. So that's the way it goes. Unfortunately, that's life. So, but going back to the rest, I mean, obviously, Matty Hayden speaks for himself. I'd played a lot against Haydos, and we'd had some great ding-dong battles in Shield cricket, but then to open the batting together was, fantastic, given that, he'd had such a successful partnership with Justin Langer. And then moving on, once he retired, then Phil Jakes, and we'd batted together a lot for New South Wales. So Jakes and I got on really well. We're good mates. We loved batting together. And, that was successful in the West Indies in, I think, 2008. And then, unfortunately, he got injured in India later.
And he doesn't get talked about a lot. Like, he averaged over 40, Jakesy.
Yeah,
like,
very his good career. Player, very good
you haven't
point.
Heard him. He's gone into coaching, so he hasn't been lost, but you never hear him begrudging what happened to him. But, he was probably a 50-test opener without injuries.
Comfortably, and I think he was certainly good enough to do that. And, unfortunately, the injuries caught up with him with his back.
Now, the next one is the late Philip Hughes. I loved the opening partnership between you two because a lot to do with your games, even though you're both left-handers. But as a right-arm bowler, it would have been an absolute nightmare. And I enjoyed that South African series, which would have to be one of the highlights of your career. I know it is with Ricky Ponting. But with your movement moving across the crease, so the bowlers attack the stumps and you're whipping them through the leg side, so you adjust to that outside off stump to get your reaching. You bowl that line to Philip Hughes, and Hughesy's uppercutting you over point for six. So you must have been, you've complimented each other. He was such a popular member of the team, but you must have got so much fun out of Steyn and Philander and Morkel. It was doing their head in.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because having spoken to Dale Steyn since finishing playing and talking about that series and just, I guess, playing against him, he has alluded to the fact that he found it really tough to counter. And he was the bowler of our generation, without a doubt. I know in my second coming in Test cricket, by far he was the greatest challenge because as an opener, you knew you were in for a challenge with a new ball because of his skill and also movement and pace. But I think what stood him out from the rest was that, he'd come back with that 60-overall ball and he'd still be at you at pace and he still made it talk off the seam or a little bit of reverse. And that's probably when he was just as dangerous, with the 60-overall ball if you'd been fortunate to get through the first 60. So, fantastic competitor. And I know for a fact, particularly that test in Durban, he was tearing his hair out bowling to Hughesy. And, I mean, it is one of the great regrets, obviously, not having played more with him and the tragic accident at the SCG. But I've got no doubt that had he come back into the test team, which would have happened, he was too good a player to play the rest of his career at first class level. He would have gone on to have a magnificent career for Australia. And, it is one of the greatest tragedies that we've ever, seen on a cricket field. And, it rocked all of us. We still can't believe it happened. But, getting to open with him in that series was a pleasure because, for me, he'd come into the New South Wales side only probably, I think, a season earlier in 2007-08 when we won the Shield. He was the youngest player ever to score a Shield 100 in the final. And, from my perspective, that first year, it felt like he was my little shadow. Wherever I looked, he was there sort of bobbing up behind me. And then to come into the test team and open together, it's something we both loved because we'd spent a fair bit of time together for New South Wales. And I was as pumped as anyone when he got that first test 100 in Durban, particularly the way he did it, plonking Harris up onto the bank there at Durban. So, it was fantastic to be a part of that, particularly as a senior player and particularly someone that had spent so much time with him and knew how special a talent he was. It was a great tour.
No, he sadly missed and what he did, from a young fella, he just scored hundreds and he would have scored many more. Just back to, some of the quicks that you faced, you're like Steyn's stock outswinger to me, obviously looked pacey. It went late, but it almost looked like it dipped. Was that an optical illusion?
No, not at all. I think the thing about Dale that even though he's quite short, you know, normally with shorter bowlers, their trajectory is quite skiddy, and so there's not much margin for error with their length. But for some reason, even though he was quite short, he still made the ball sort of torque off the seam, but also it stood up. So he still got a bit of bounce for someone of his height, because he's not overly tall. I think he would have only been probably about 6 foot, which, you know, similar height to myself. But it always felt like when he hit the seam, it bounced nicely, and it wasn't just skidding onto your bat, which is normally the case for sort of bowlers of that height. But I think, yeah, as I mentioned before, I know we were due to play him in a test at the Wacker in, I think it was 2008 or 9, that series, and all the press were talking him up to be bowling 160, and I was thinking, God, how am I going to face this? So we got into the nets and practiced on the machine and cranked it up full belt, and I thought, that's all I can do to prepare myself. And then we got out in the middle, and he only bowled mid-140s, and it was just a nice, easy pace. So it just goes to show that if you obviously make training harder than the game, hopefully come game time you can just go out there and play. But I think he was probably one of the, if not the greatest bowler of our era. You know, he's obviously, Jimmy Anderson's obviously still going, but I think across all conditions and the type of bowler that he was, yeah, Dale Steyn for mine was number one.
Who got you out, Caddo? Anyone underrated that just used to nibble you out a little bit?
Oh, plenty of guys got me out, mate. You know, it depends what sort of form you're in. There's plenty of times that was an easy wicket. Other times, hopefully, you made guys work hard for your wicket. I think in Test cricket, probably the greatest challenge was Flintoff in that 05 Ashes.
Oh.
And particularly batting at six. Like, it was a spot that was, I found, tricky to bat in, facing an older ball, having been used to being at the top of the order for so long. So that was probably my biggest challenge. And then probably Murali in Sri Lanka. But he was a very enjoyable challenge as well, because you knew if you could last against him, you could last against any spinner, given all his tricks.
I'm glad you mentioned facing Flintoff, because I was batting at six. Well, you've got to have empathy for us tail enders when we used to come in against the second new ball.
Correct.
And the ball's going everywhere and everyone's bowling quicker. Western Australian born, very impressed by the way that you played spin. Where did that come from?
It took a lot of work. I know when I first started for WA, there was always probably a perception that, you know, guys from WA didn't play spin that well because the whacker didn't turn much. So it was probably one of the reasons why when I moved to New South Wales, I knew that if I wanted to play for Australia, I was going to have to get better at it. So I think initially I used to sweep a bit, and you can get away with it on a good, true, bouncy WA wicket. Doesn't spin much, true bounce. And if you've got a decent eye, you can get away with it. But when you come on subcontinent wickets where some bounce, some don't, some spin, some don't, you know, you have to look for other ways to survive and score. So I know when I moved to Sydney, I made a really conscious effort to use my feet more. And I think as soon as I started to do that, I became a far better player of spin, looking to hit spinners straight. I learned how to use my pad more to be able to defend out of the rough, particularly, you know, come day 3, 4, 5 in a test match, where you sometimes you have to survive for the first 20 minutes just to get used to the conditions. So all those little parts of my game got better with, I guess, the move to Sydney and also getting exposed to subcontinental conditions. Because I think I played a fair few tests in my career out of the 56 in the subcontinent, whether it was India or Sri Lanka or wherever. So, yeah, it's something that I certainly prided myself on trying to get better at that at part of my game.
And, Caddo, I always like the different cultures. What did you notice the difference between Western Australian Shield getting into the young bloke as a young bloke with, you know, Moody and Julian and Angel and Langer and Martin, and then crossing over to New South Wales as an older player? What would you, a couple of different things that you perceive, the difference in the cultures between the two states?
Yeah, look, I was pretty fortunate that I'd sort of known a lot of the WA boys from a young age, because I played club cricket at Midland Guildford with about four of them. From when I was 16 years of age. So Tom Moody was at my club. So was Brendan Julian. So was Joe Angel. So was Tim Zura. So I was blessed to have all these mentors that when I moved into the WA squad at 18, they probably took it easier on me. And I know talking to guys like Huss and Rob Baker and these guys that came from other clubs, whilst they loved their time playing for WA, it was also a different dynamic for them, and maybe the Midland boys took it easier on me, and given Moods was captain at the time, you know, he's been like a mentor to me for my whole career, not just as a player, but also now as a coach. So, I look back on that time really fondly, and I think now the way my career's played out, I'm very blessed to have had, you know, that group around me as a young player, and I learned so much from them, not just about cricket, but also off the field and how they, you know, how they approach life, and particularly from Tom and Wayne Clark, who was coach at the time. So very, very blessed. And then to move to Sydney in, I think it was 2002 when I was about 27, completely different dynamic. Obviously a very experienced team with, you know, the War Brothers and McGrath, Bevan, Slater, McGill, all these guys. You know, I probably missed a few there as well. You know, there's so many guys. So Slater, different dynamic. But the New South Wales boys made me feel very welcome, and I'm blessed for that as well, because it is a daunting group to come in to that sort of, you know, group from another state. I didn't think I was going to move to another state. You know, it's just the way things played out. And yeah, I love my time playing for New South Wales with those guys, and had some very special memories, and certainly learned. I think if anything, I probably learned to believe and back myself more, and that's probably something that Steve Waugh drew out of me. You probably do it, but I think it went to another level in New South Wales, and particularly with my bowling. And yeah, those guys, particularly Steve in particular, deserve a lot of credit for that.
Yeah. What does it feel like to have the best test figures of six for? Because I wouldn't know.
Yeah, but I don't know what it's like to get a couple of hat tricks. So, look, in terms of.
Oh, it should have been two, yeah.
Yeah, I know. I didn't want to remind you, but look, in terms of that, I was pretty blessed, mate. There was a fair few caught out at deep mid-wicket, and I think Ricky caught one in at short leg, which was make half.
But behind that, did you want to give yourself another option to be seen as a three-dimensional player? Like, you know, had Bebo on last podcast, played about half a dozen tests, really, as the second spinner. So it got him a game because it was so competitive for spots with middle-order players. So was it in the back of your mind to actually give the selectors another thing to think about, that you could bowl some handy overs?
I think at the time you had to, because I think given the nature of the top six in Australian cricket, it was so strong that you sort of had to bring other skills to the table. And, you know, particularly with the way the top five were, if there was an opportunity, it was always generally for a younger player at six. So you couldn't just, you know, force your way into the top three or four because of the way the team was structured. And, you know, that number six spot sometimes an all-rounder, and the guys I was competing with were always guys that, you know, could bat, but obviously potentially had the opportunity to bowl as well. So I loved bowling. It's something I spent a lot of time working at. And I know prior to getting into that test side in 2003, 2004, I'd been at Hampshire playing, and they'd sort of recruited me on the back of a season for New South Wales where I'd bowled a fair bit. And I spent a lot of time that summer in county cricket bowling, and I loved it. I felt like I was a genuine all-rounder at that point in time in my career, because I was, you know, batting at three or four and then, you know, bowling sometimes 15, 20 overs a game, and loved being in the game, loved trying to help win games of cricket, and yeah, that's where it all came from.
Yeah, and at times in the last few years, we've struggled, haven't we, just with the part-time bowling options. You know, we had the two wars in the day. You know, Greg Blewett was a handy fast-medium bowler, spinners, yourself, Bevo. Mark Waugh ended up bowling off spinners, didn't he? So Mark Taylor was excellent as a captain. Often he'd bring on someone like that just before lunch, and the amount of times he got wickets. Just on a coaching, Justin Langer, obviously getting a lot of media about him at the moment, not so much about Alfie himself, but what about coaching at international level? You know, where do you see it going? I know you're doing it more at domestic level at the moment, but, you know, one is the time away from home. You know, do the roles eventually have to get split? And then also, do you notice a difference between younger players and what they want out of the game as opposed to when you debuted all those years ago?
Yeah, I definitely think it's changed. I think I don't envy the young players now, because I think the way that cricket's structured now, there's so much cricket, which is great from a development point of view because you can get a lot of games in a short space of time. But the way our season's structured in particular, I don't envy our young batsmen, because, you know, we didn't have the T20 comp hijacking the summer like it is at the moment. And I love the Big Bash. The problem is it has an impact on our test batting, because you've got this sort of 6 to 8 week hiatus where guys don't face a red ball. And we all know that a white ball doesn't do anywhere near as much. And if you're trying to break into a test team, yes, there's Shield games beforehand, but if you don't play them for a month and then there's an injury and someone has to play in mid-January, it's tough. So I think it is tricky for the young guys now. I think from a coaching perspective, I definitely think countries are going to start looking at splitting the roles, because I just think the volume of cricket that's played, and particularly now with COVID and the bubbles and the quarantine times and stuff like that, it's just not viable for coaches, particularly those with young families, to be away all year round. It probably puts too much pressure on the family. Families can't travel as much. I know firsthand recently, you know, a lot of the decisions around what I was doing coaching-wise in this next year or so were around no COVID, because I made the decision in 2019 prior to COVID, and my family were going to travel to IPL for a week or two and come to England for 2 weeks of the school holidays. Now they can't do that. They could, but quarantine makes it almost impossible with young kids. So it's changed the landscape. And I think a lot of the countries around, given the volume of cricket in international cricket, will start to maybe split the roles, because, you know, there are different, the formats are so different now between test cricket and T20 cricket. So I can see potentially being red ball coach and a white ball coach in time. And and then the coaches themselves find a really good balance between work and family. And I think potentially everyone benefits from that, and the players potentially benefit as well from having, you know, maybe different squads or specialist squads. And because I know personally, having just been a test player at the end of my career, I felt like I had a big advantage just playing test cricket and then going back and playing first class cricket for New South Wales or county cricket and not chopping and changing all the time. Whereas guys that were playing all three formats, you know, at some point the schedule catches up with you because of the volume of cricket and the differences to your technique that creep in. So, yeah, I can see that happening.
Yeah, I definitely have probably more empathy for the batters than the bowlers these days. To adjust to three different forms, you know, is really tough, probably mentally and tactically more than physical, whereas for the faster bowlers, it's probably physical. I said I caught up with Michael Bevan last podcast, a reality superstar. Probably the highlight was as Hammerhead, I think, on the Australian Masked Singer. When reality TV wanted their most famous cricketing chef, they didn't go to Matthew Hayden. They come knocking on your door. You went okay. What cost you in the end? Celebrity MasterChef, what hurt you?
Well, if I'm being honest,
because you love a feed, don't you? You're one of Australia's great cricketing eaters.
I should be 20 kilos heavier than I am, Flem, with the amount of food I put away. But I've been blessed with I think good genetics and a good metabolism, because I've always been pretty skinny. But look, loved my time in the MasterChef kitchen. I think what cost me, and I've been honest here, like for 90 minutes, I had to cook behind Miss Universe Australia, Rachel Finch. So it was pretty tough to concentrate. But look, in terms of the experience, I guess, you know, I didn't really know what to expect from MasterChef. I love my cooking. But what I realised was after it had aired on TV, I was down at the local Woolworths doing a bit of shopping. And the Ashes, I'd just been in the Ashes in 2009, got home, and a couple of young blokes came up to me at the counter, and I thought, oh, these young blokes obviously love their cricket. Anyway, they came up, and the first thing they said, hey, Kat, how do you cook spatchcock? And I was blown away, because it was the last thing I was expecting them to say to me at the checkout at Woolworths. And so we had a bit of fun with it. But great experience. The judges were great, passed on a lot of good tips. But ultimately, mate, I'm a home cook. I love cooking at home for my boys and wife and family, and that's why I did it. I don't think I would have done anything else, but cooking is my passion, so I thought, why not? And it was a really good experience.
All right, we'll put your name down for the Masked Singer next year, Ben.
Bed and I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition.
What about the commentary side? We're lucky enough to commentate together with Seven and SEN. How have you found that?
Mate, I've been so blessed, because when I finished playing, I went into working at the Giants for a couple of years, and then the opportunity came to work with Jared Waitley and Chris Rogers and Dirk Nowness and Jim Maxwell at the ABC. And I thought, oh, why not? I never thought I'd do something like that, but I thought I'll try it, and loved it. And then it sort of morphed into doing the TV with you guys on Seven. And I mean, the thing that I love the most is the team we've got and working with everyone, very professional. I've learned a lot with obviously a lot of experienced broadcasters like yourself and the rest of the guys on the crew, the Seven crew, obviously. But I think the thing that, you know, stands out the most is, you know, we're getting to do a job that we love, you know, commentating on the game we love, watching fantastic cricket and trying to hopefully bring some insights into, you know, the people at home in Australia. And, you know, it's an unbelievable job. So I feel really lucky to work with both crews like SEN and Channel 7. And I guess the thing that I've learnt the most is, you know, is that it's still, even though it's a different job, there's still a team environment, and that's probably the best part of the job is trying to put together, you know, a great broadcast for everyone at home.
No, certainly so. We enjoy your work, Catter. Now, you don't have a busy September either because your loved Tigers haven't made the finals after winning 3 out of 4 years, but you alluded to your role at the Giants. You know, what was the actual role and, you know, how did it come about and what did you learn from it?
Yeah, look, it was to set up a leadership program with our sports psych in the first year. And then it was also learning about the footy operations manager role with a view to potentially maybe doing that down the track with more experience. So I think the first year, the leadership program was, you know, an opportunity to get to know our young leadership group. And just sort of, when I say leadership program, it was more around having the weekly meeting and asking the questions around, you know, what's worked on game day, what hasn't, feeding that back to the coaches. And then also having, you know, sessions with emerging leaders around their development. So giving them tasks, whether it's, you know, reading a chapter of a leadership book or doing some stuff that we did with New South Wales Police where we did some communication skill work and things like that. But ultimately it came down to, you know, having a program where the players judged each other and their leadership on standards of behaviour at the club. So just having those conversations face-to-face with the leaders, with the young players and giving open and honest feedback, that was probably one of the biggest parts of the role. And, yeah, great group to work with, highly professional. I certainly learned a lot being there for 2 years and loved my time there. And, yeah, in terms of what was the other part of the question again?
I just said, what did you learn?
Yeah, well, I guess the thing that I learned was that, you know, the attention to detail in the AFL is second to none. Obviously, they study a lot of the American professional sports and the way they coach and the way they develop young talent. And I think that's something that I certainly took with me now into my roles coaching in T20 is the time and effort that gets put into developing young players, whether it's the use of the footage and the data and having those weekly, you know, catch-ups with players to run them through how they're performing either in training, in games, and just, yeah, that detail that they do. Cricket was always very informal, as you know, mate. You might have those conversations over a beer at the bar or at dinner and I think that's, you know, it's a really great part of the game, but there was a more structured way to the way they do it in AFL that I certainly think that, you know, I've tried to embrace with the cricket coaching side of things, particularly in T20 where a lot of the game comes down to decision making, and you can talk through those experiences with players after the event, or even before the event, from a tactical perspective.
Now, a lot of cricketers are doing pre-season, well, trying to do some pre-season in lockdown. What would your advice be for left-hand opening batsmen going into a season? What do they need to do?
Get over to England if you can, because I think, like, I look back on a lot of our era, and I think so many guys develop their games playing, you know, in England, whether it's league cricket, county cricket. I mean, I know that the dynamics change now. Guys can go and play IPL in the T20 leagues. But if you want to be a test opener or a test batsman, then I think at some point you've got to do your time in English conditions and getting more first-class cricket under your belt. And I just think, you know, a great example of that in recent times, Marnus Labuschagne a couple of years ago, you know, had a great season for Glamorgan. Wasn't a lock in the test team, got an opportunity, has nailed it, and now he's one of the best test batsmen in the world, and he's still got plenty of great years in front of him. So I'd be encouraging all our young players, wouldn't be worried about what they're getting paid, just ask a county if there's an opportunity for them. I love the fact that, you know, young Josh Inglis went over this year, even though he's only playing white ball cricket, he's got exposure, done really well. Marcus Harris went over, played some good cricket for Leicester. There's some good examples there, and I think, you know, more of our young batsmen that can do that, the better.
Well, that stumps, Caddo. I can see the surf's just starting to get up there in Barbados, so I better let you get out there. Mate, thanks for the chat. Looking forward to catching up over the summer for commentary. And most of all, good luck.
Thanks very much, Flem.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
That's it for the Bowlology Report. Thanks, Caddo.
Pleasure, mate.